This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. On September 15, 1963, four little girls in the ladies' lounge of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham were preparing for a church service and Sunday school when a bomb planted at the church by members of the Ku Klux Klan exploded. Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Denise McNair were killed in the blast. Days later, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave a eulogy.
These children, unoffending, innocent, and beautiful, were the victims of one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity.
Today we look back at the bombing in Birmingham nearly 50 years later. First, we're going to talk with Chapel Hill resident Billy Barnes. Billy Barnes lived in Atlanta in 1963 and attended the funeral for three of the little girls. Billy Barnes, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us about your decision. What were you doing and why did you decide to go to the funeral?
Well, I was a journalist in Atlanta at the time, and I was working for a magazine publishing company. And at my church that Sunday morning of the bombing, I learned about it, and my family learned about it. And, of course, we were deeply disturbed. And I worried it over during the night. And the next morning at work, I talked with a fellow journalist, and I said, Jack, I feel like I've got to do something, and the only thing I can think of is to go to the funeral and show a white face and go sit with the mourners and let them know that I care. And Jack said, I'll go with you. So in the morning of the funeral, we got up early and drove to Birmingham. And when we arrived at the church, it was surrounded by a circle of policemen. I figured that there was fear that the bombers might come back. The usher at the door assumed that, being white, we were representatives of the news media. We told him, no, we didn't want to be in the press section. We wanted to sit with the local folks. We were seated on the front row of the balcony looking down, and we saw that row of little coffins at the front of the church and the families of the girls sitting in the pews nearest the coffins. I remember it was hot and steamy inside that church, and down below there was the sound of sobbing and moaning, the likes of which I had never heard before or since. And there were a half dozen ladies in white dresses moving among them, and I asked someone sitting near us what was going on, and he said they were offering smelling salts to those who felt faint. The only other thing I remember was that there was a lot of singing and many speakers. But finally, stepping out from the side curtains over on kind of stage right, Martin Luther King Jr. stepped out, and there was a long pause. And the first words out of his mouth were taken from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19. And when Jesus was come near, he beheld the city and wept. And I don't remember anything else after that. I didn't remember what he said, but those words still ring.
Were there many other white folks who were not members of the press in that group, in that church that day?
Relatively few. I won't say there weren't any, but relatively few.
Well, you said you felt like you had to do something. I think you said something about showing solidarity or something along those lines, if I'm remembering what you said. What did it actually feel like for you in that church during?
Well, I was a little bit scared when I saw all those policemen surrounding the building, and I was very hot. It was a scorcher, and this was before the days when churches were air conditioned, and I was just very moved. I was moved by the crying and moaning, and I was moved by the number of people who were in the church and had risked a little bit to come. And And then when the what I just quoted Martin Luther King Jr. saying as he stepped out on the stage was very, very moving. And I'm still moved by the memory of it.
You talked about being a journalist in Atlanta. Had you been covering the civil rights movement, and whether or not you had, did this event change you politically or in terms of your understanding of what was happening in that movement?
Well, I was up until that time was very sympathetic with the movement, and their movement was very, very obvious in Atlanta. There was a lot of picketing going on. There hadn't been any violence to speak of. But this, of course, was a... I don't know that I would say it was life-changing. I was already... I already realized the evils of segregation. But I... My job as a journalist was mostly to report on business, mm-hmm. business aspects of American life in the South. So, I had not been actively involved, only peripherally from time to time, with the struggle. But you ask me what effect did it have on me. I will say this. The following year, I was... I asked to come back to my home state of North Carolina and work for a statewide nonprofit group that was established by Terry Sanford to work with problems of poverty and race. And I said, yes, I will. And so I've been here ever since.
Is that the North Carolina Fund?
Yeah, right. Correct.
Yeah. Billy Barnes, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Billy Barnes is a Chapel Hill resident who attended the funeral for three of the girls who were killed in the Birmingham church bombing in 1963. Glenn Eskew joins us now. He is helping us reflect on that day, September of 1963. Glenn Eskew is the author of But for Birmingham, The Local and National Movements in the Civil Rights Struggle, and he's a history professor at Georgia State University. Glenn Eskew, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the climate in Birmingham around this time. This was not the first bombing in Birmingham around the civil rights movement.
No. In fact, there were an estimated 50 bombings that occurred in the city of Birmingham after the Second World War up through this civil rights era. And the bombings had been unsolved, for the most part, by the Birmingham Police Department or the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The whole purpose behind the bombings had been to maintain the status quo in race relations, which was a defense of white supremacy. And that segregated social order reinforced, of course, racism in the workplace. And Birmingham, being the industrial center of the New South, had relied on racial exploitation in employment in the heavy industry. Blacks paid less than whites, whites paid a little bit more, but both actually about half of what you might earn in the same industry in the North. But nonetheless, it created a dynamic for white workers to maintain segregation, and they did. And it was borne out by the behavior of vigilantes, racial extremists willing to kill to protect segregation. And that climate in the city had been building. Of course, by September 15th of 1963, you find a Birmingham in transition. This had been, after all, the center of civil rights protests in the spring. It was where the local civil rights movement, led by the Reverend Fred L. Shuttlesworth, joined by Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, had conducted massive street demonstrations that culminated in the Children's Crusade. Such intensity in the call for civil rights reform that the Kennedy administration was ultimately forced to intervene, and out of that would be the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So Birmingham was in a state of transition, moving out of that segregated environment. And the Klansmen, when they struck that Sunday morning, did so out of desperation to try to hang on to segregation, to try to protect white supremacy. And a lot of that frustration was fueled by the behavior of Alabama's Governor George Wallace. Wallace had stood in the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama in June of 63, trying to stave off the federal desegregation of the college system, and failed in that endeavor. And in the fall of 1963, in September, the courts ruled that Birmingham had to desegregate its public schools, and the schools were being desegregated in the 2 weeks building up to the 16th Street Church bombing.
Well, yeah, and it was Wallace who said just a week before the bombing, he tells the New York Times, quote, "What we need to stop integration is a few first-class funerals."
Exactly. Exactly.
We are talking about the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing 50 years ago, or nearly 50 years ago today, and our conversation with Glenn Eskew, the author of But for Birmingham, continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing nearly 50 years later. Glenn Eskew is the author of But for Birmingham, the Local and National Movements in the Civil Rights Struggle. He's also a history professor at Georgia State University. We were talking about the atmosphere in Birmingham in the decades that led up to the bombing. And in the aftermath, in fact, there were two more child deaths after the bombing itself. Tell us about those, Glenn.
Yes, indeed. Well, again, that climate of the city had been ratcheted up with racial hatred being fomented from the governor's office all the way down into the streets where these vigilantes, Klansmen, were encouraging resistance, massive resistance to the calls for school desegregation. And in the tragic aftermath of the church bombing, initially you find the African-American community coming out, as it always did after these dynamite attacks. What marked 16th Street, of course, as exceptional were the deaths. While there had been over 50 dynamite attacks in the city since the Second World War, no one miraculously had been killed. Although the Reverend Shuttlesworth, the leader of the local movement, nearly died in 1956, he survived it, this symbol of divine intervention that helped propel the movement to its success.
And can you tell us, I want to interrupt you for a moment, what was being dynamited? What kinds of structures were blowing
up? All kinds of things. Anything that was seen as advocating racial change. Initially, the dynamitings really stem out of the labor movement from the 1930s, 20s and 30s, teens even, when there were calls for interracial unions in the coal mines. But by the post-war era, it's clearly targeting African-Americans who are engaged in pushing against the color line. Birmingham was resistant in allowing the expansion of black neighborhoods in that post-war era when, of course, there were huge housing booms to address the shortages that had been pent up for two decades. But the city leaders wanted to restrict the growth of the black population in the city to try to hang on to a majority white, and consequently refused to allow new neighborhoods to be developed for black housing. Consequently, African Americans were stuck with trying to buy housing in formerly white areas, as they were called. This in clear violation, by the way, of the U.S. Supreme Court, which had ruled segregated neighborhoods unconstitutional. Nonetheless, African Americans who bought houses in or constructed houses in kind of no man's land between black and white neighborhoods, before they moved in, they often found them dynamited. And the outcome was the sobriquet for the city of Bombingham. That's where Birmingham got the nickname. Dynamite was used, of course, because this was an industrial city, and there were coal mines and ore mines scattered around the district, and dynamite was prevalent and readily available. And with the emergence of the modern civil rights movement under the leadership of Reverend Shuttlesworth in 1956, we see the targets then becoming the civil rights leaders. Shuttlesworth himself, when he announces a challenge on bus segregation after the Supreme Court ruled from the Montgomery case that buses were to be desegregated that very night prior to the protest in Birmingham, Klansmen lob six sticks of dynamite at Shuttlesworth's parsonage, and it blows it up, damages the church next door, blows the windows out. But the The piers are blown out from under the house. The porch caves in. The roof collapses. It was miraculous, indeed, that Shuttlesworth emerged out of that rubble. Well, these types of attacks, and in the 2 weeks building up to the 16th Street Church bombing, the local civil rights attorney, Arthur Shores, his house was bombed twice, right on the eve of school desegregation, and then again after the courts had stepped back in, and through federal intervention, we find the schools will be opened. Attorney Shores' house is bombed a second time, in which his wife is injured, the pet is killed. It's just one dynamiting after another, it seems. Even Angela Davis, as a young girl growing up on what became called Dynamite Hill, talks about how this violence affected her as a child. So by the 16th Street Church bombing, in the aftermath, the black community poured out of their homes and surrounded the church. The police had difficulty restoring order. A near riot broke out. Elsewhere in the city, you find black youth and white youth clashing with rocks being thrown at each other. Meanwhile, white authorities are holding rallies in support of massive resistance to try to reclaim segregated schools. At a huge rally, the bomber himself is seen in attendance. And it's in that environment that two young black men, boys really, get shot down in the streets of Birmingham. One was a man named Johnny Robinson. He was 16 years old, and he and a bunch of other black youth were on the streets clashing with white youth. There were a group of white high schoolers riding around in a car decorated with Confederate flags, hollering racial epithets in the black neighborhood. And these black youth threw rocks back at this provocation. The police show up, and in the course of trying to break up this clash, the police open fire, and Johnny Robinson is shot dead in the back. Yet another legal lynching in the city. And this kind of police brutality had a long history in Birmingham. There probably was the shooting of a black man by city police every month. It was a real tragedy, but a way through force that the city maintained segregation. Then shortly after that, later in the afternoon, two white youth who had attended one of these segregation rallies were riding around on a motor scooter. And in the course of driving down one street, they come upon two black youth, not much younger than themselves. A boy of 13 named Virgil Ware, riding on the handlebars of the bike, coming towards them. And these white 16-year-olds, both of whom were Eagle Scouts, one drew a gun and fired it, hitting Virgil Ware in the chest and then in the head, dead.
So that's two more victims, essentially, in the aftermath. Interestingly enough, this points to one of the most serious debates within the civil rights movement before that, and that's the involvement of children. You talked about the success of that Children's Crusade or campaign in Birmingham. Martin Luther King himself was very reluctant to bring children into this, however effective it might be, for this very reason.
No, that's exactly right. In fact, when the Children's Crusade breaks out, it's out of desperation. The movement was near collapse. It was very much like what had transpired in Albany. It had really failed to generate the kind of pressure on the local community, much less a federal intervention, to create change. And yet, in an amazing moment, the decision was made to let school children march that fateful day in May 2nd, 1963. Children had been involved in the movement, of course. While the adults were attending the mass meetings ever since the campaign began on April 2nd, they would bring their children to the meetings, and the children would gather in the fellowship halls or to engage in nonviolent workshops or games, but they weren't part of the actual movement that had been involved in the larger demonstrations. At least most weren't. And yet, once King's lieutenants got involved that spring and began to train some of these young people, it occurred to them, Dorothy Cotton, James Bevel, Ike Reynolds, that these young people certainly could be engaging in the civil rights protest.
It's a critical movement, a moment of growth. Not only are we now bringing children into the movement, but churches themselves who had been reluctant, ministers in black churches who had been reluctant, are being won over. The 16th Street Church itself was one that had only recently become involved. Tell us about its involvement in the movement.
Absolutely true. Well, 16th Street, of course, was Birmingham's premier black Baptist church. It was a middle-class church. And as such, it did approach race reform, of course, wanted that, but did so in a different fashion, usually a more legalistic approach. And the Reverend Shuttlesworth and his movement was rooted in the lower middle class of the black community or working class, strivers who were determined to create race reform to improve the lives of their families in a fashion that attracted, well, with Shuttlesworth's movement, these folks were religious fanatics. They firmly believed God would help them overthrow segregation, and that the emotional aspect of their expression of faith tended to turn off a more middle-class people. And this created a problem for Dr. King when he agreed to come in to assist Shuttlesworth in the demonstrations that spring of 63. He arrived thinking that 16th Street Church would be involved. After all, he knew Reverend John Cross, the pastor there, had grown up knowing him and his father, and consequently anticipated that 16th Street would be involved in the demonstrations, and it wasn't. And it was only after King convinced Cross to allow the movement to hold mass meetings and in the church that the pastor and indeed the congregation reluctantly agreed to. There was fear on the part of Cross and his congregation because of the fear of retaliation. Shuttlesworth's church was bombed three times as a result of its civil rights activity.
Well, this is certainly an important moment for Dr. King and this movement. As you say, had been trying desperately to get more churches on board, and they were facing all of the challenges that you point out, mortal challenges. So let's listen to then the eulogy where Dr. King uses this moment, the eulogy in the aftermath of the church bombing, to once again exhort fellow church members and others now to become a part of this movement.
And so this afternoon, in a real sense, they have something to say to each of us in that death. They have something to say to every minister of the gospel who has remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. They have something to say to every politician who has fed his constituents with the stale bread of hatred and the spoiled meat of racism. They have something to say to a federal government that has compromised with the undemocratic practices of Southern Dixiecrats and the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing Northern Republicans. They have something to say to every Negro who has passively accepted the evil system of segregation and who has stood on the sidelines in a mighty struggle for justice.
Of course, Dr. Martin Luther King is part of the eulogy in the aftermath of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in Birmingham nearly 50 years ago. Glenn Eskew is with me, author of But for Birmingham, teaches history at Georgia State. Was that a turning point in the movement? Did it bring, did it change the minds of many of those pastors who had been on the fence?
You know, that's an excellent question. And I would pair that eulogy with the letter from Birmingham Jail, in which King lays out really a criticism of white moderates for not supporting the civil rights struggle. And there had been discussion in the movement for a while that there was a need to attract these people who aren't supporting it. Why aren't they? These should be the logical advocates for our reform movement. It would be nice to see it that way, that it does encourage others to get involved. You know, I'm not so sure. Certainly, nationally, the bombing just emphasized the need for race reform. And this is coming in the climate, of course, of nationally of just coming out of the high of the March on Washington, where a quarter of a million people had stood there around the Lincoln Memorial listening to Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, and millions watched from television. And so nationally, there was a definite shift, and that shift can be rooted really to Birmingham, because it's in the crisis of Birmingham in May of 63 with the arrest of the children that the federal government decides to get involved. You mentioned the children earlier. You know, it was the children made the transition. That was the watershed moment, and it was condemned by others. Malcolm X would say, "Real men don't put their children on the firing line." But had those children not gotten involved, the movement very likely would have collapsed, and there wouldn't have been the dynamic for the race reform that followed. And it wasn't just from Birmingham. Birmingham pressured the nation. There were hundreds of demonstrations in cities scattered around the country. There were over 15,000 arrests linked to civil rights and civil rights protests across America, the North, the West, in the weeks after the Birmingham demonstrations. Mm-hmm. And the Kennedy administration was forced to respond. But backing that up, this protests in the streets that led to the realization was the need for race reform was the very violence. And it wasn't just these six people in Birmingham who got killed that day in September, but Medgar Evers was shot in his driveway.
Forgive me for interrupting, but the interesting thing now is how you interpret this for children today. And for that, I want to talk with Carol Weatherford, who joins our program to talk about this. Her new book is called Birmingham 1963, and it's a poetic tribute to the four little girls whose lives were taken, and it's a children's book, Birmingham 1963. Carol Weatherford, welcome back to the program. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be back on again.
Tell us about this book and why you wrote it.
Well, the book is a poem written in free verse. It's aimed at middle grade, so like third grade, maybe up to about eighth grade. And I wrote it so that children wouldn't forget that the kinds of sacrifices that that were made in the freedom struggle. A lot of times, they study Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, and some kids tend to, oversimplify the civil rights movement and think that, Dr. King delivered the I Have a Dream speech and then everything changed. Well, no, it wasn't quite that simple. And a lot of people lost their lives in the struggle and made other kinds of sacrifices, people whose names have since been forgotten. And I want to make sure that these four girls' names are not forgotten.
How do you reflect this to children? I mean, one of the problems is it's a violent act. It's a scary thing. And they were not deliberately and intentionally on the front lines. They were innocent victims. They were in church. They weren't marching. How do you reflect that? And what goes through your mind as an author in trying to present this to young children?
Of course, that's what made the event so shocking at the time, the fact that the girls were not on the front line and they were innocent victims. And that's what galvanized the nation and shocked and shamed the nation. Well, what I did was to present the event through the eyes of a fictional eyewitness. So although the book is written in free verse, it's also historical fiction. And I gave the fictional narrator a birthday on the day of the bombing. So the day was a milestone. It starts out as a kind of a red letter day for her. And she's a member of 16th Street Baptist Church and, of course, witnesses the bombing and survives it. And on a day that was, should have been very happy for her, a big deal birthday, the big 1-0 in the life of a child, becomes a day that she remembers because of this bombing. And she lost, the girls weren't her friends because they were older than she, but she lost people that she knew. And she saw her father cry for the very first time. So, it's the action kind of builds from, things that she's doing to get ready for church that day.
Have you done readings with children, and how do they respond?
Oh, I have, and not just from this book, but from other books that I've written about African-American history and particularly about the freedom struggle. And their response is always the same. I always preface the reading by putting the story in historical context and letting them know that this is based on true events or this, it's about something that really happened. And when they, after they've heard the story, you know, it's pretty usually pretty quiet, and I ask them, invite them to ask questions, and generally the question is, did that really happen? They just can't believe that the kind of racism and hate violence that we have in our history in the United States really took place, really existed.
Carol Weatherford, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Carol Weatherford, an English professor at Fayetteville State University and the author of the children's book Birmingham 1963. And Glenn Eskew is the author of But for Birmingham, The Local and National Movements in the Civil Rights Struggle, and a history professor at Georgia State University. Glenn Eskew, thank you for being on the program as well.
Thank you very much for asking.
Coming up next, charter school expansion in North Carolina. Stay tuned.